Most of that Kias are pretty run down. The tatami mats are old, and we looked at a bunch of places that were, pretty sad. I mean, pots and pans still on the stove, and like grandma got hauled out and sent to a, a rest home or something, and the house is just sort of frozen in time. And we looked at quite a few of those places, and some of them are beautiful, beautiful old places with amazing woodwork and just beautiful built-ins, and I mean there's some amazing stuff, but you should save some budget for upgrades for sure. One of the things we saw probably the most is Daidokoro and Otera, right? So mostly bathrooms. Pretty much plan on remodeling a bathroom and remodeling the kitchen. Most of the older abandoned homes have bathrooms from the 50s, 50s or 60s or something, and definitely need some remodeling. But still, when you compare real estate in other first world countries, I mean, there's just no comparison. I mean, Japan is truly a first world country with first world medical, first world transportation, communications. I mean, it's a first world country, and you're getting, you're buying real estate at sort of 1970s prices, compared to, at least compared to the US. So it's a, it's a pretty amazing frontier for a real estate investor, I think.
Hi there, folks, and welcome or welcome back to Nippon Trading International's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima again, and this podcast is brought to you, among others, by Emil Gorgis of realestate.jp. He's a Tokyo real estate agent who specializes in serving international or mixed nationality families who are looking for the perfect family home. So Emil's an Australian. He's been living here in Japan for over two decades now. And for about half of that time, he's been buying, selling, and managing real estate properties in Tokyo on behalf of his own family and a great many happy clients. And he also acts as a mortgage broker on behalf of his clients. So he's got dedicated loan officers in many of the Japanese mega banks. And if you're a regular listener of the podcast, you probably already know him from our JREP, the Japan Real Estate Experts panel sessions, which means that you're already aware of the fact that the man is an absolute fountain of wisdom on all things related to real estate in Japan, and in particular to family homes, the greater Tokyo metropolitan area, and mortgages. And most importantly, he's incredibly generous with his time and advice, which he's more than happy to provide at no cost or commitment to anyone asking. So if you've been thinking about buying your home in Tokyo, but you've been sitting on the fence for a while, or you just want to have a chat in English with a real expert, drop him a line on sales@realestate.jp. Hit him up today and start exploring your options. All right, so for today's episode, this is more of a laid-back storytelling type of conversation, but with some very useful tips for any of you who are considering purchasing a holiday or family home in Japan, and especially if this is going to be your first purchase here. So it's a conversation I had with one of our consulting clients, and we first talk about what brought him to Japan in the first place, so a bit of his personal life story, and then what made him want to buy a house here and how he went about it, his thoughts on construction, renovations, on how he chose his locations and came up with his final shortlist, and then finally zeroed in on the one property that he wanted to move forward with. This guy's also a builder and a bit of a Japanese history buff, so we talk history, Japanese architecture, building methods over the ages, and why these homes are not built to last. And we then dive into the purchase process itself, and most importantly, into all of the things that first-time buyers to Japan who are experienced in purchasing property overseas, which, if you've been following this podcast for a while, I've mentioned on many occasions, these are the folks most likely to make mistakes simply because they think they know what they don't know. So this is also a bit of a cautionary tale about why it might be a good idea to hire a local professional, someone with experience in the market and familiarity with its dynamics, potential complications, working with realtors, property lawyers here, legislation, regulations for short-term stay licensing, structural inspections, negotiations, cultural norms, somebody who actually knows how
everything works here and is on your side. So really interesting conversation, I thought. And for a change, you'll hear far less of me talking and a lot more from our guest, which is a refreshing change for many of you, I'm sure. Enjoy the conversation, and I'll see you again on the other side.
Okay,
so thank you for agreeing to talk to me, and thank you also for allowing me to record. I just wanted to have this chat with you and then hopefully publish it on our YouTube channel and podcast, and then forward the recording to people who are in similar situations, because I think your story is probably something that people want to be aware of. But can you start with a bit of a background? Just tell us about yourselves and how you came to want to purchase a property in Japan and that sort of thing.
Okay. Well, I assume your audience is primarily English speaking.
Correct.
So my wife's English is a little limited. So we communicate pretty well, but I will do most of the talking. But
yeah.
But
it sounds like my Japanese. That's absolutely fine.
Yeah. So, but interrupt me if you want to add something or say something.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously we're married, and I've always loved Japan. It goes actually way back to my childhood. My nanny was Japanese. I grew up in California with a Japanese nanny.
Oh, wow.
With a stepmother doing high holidays. And it was sort of an interesting upbringing I had. I've always loved Japan, and I've been there 12 times. And Lieko has a really nice little house there in Niigata, in the northern sort of north central part of Niigata. But it's a life estate. And for those that don't know what a life estate is, it's basically you don't own the house, but you're allowed to sort of live there your whole life. And Japan's kind of interesting because a lot of houses are on property that are like somebody can own the house, but the property in this case is owned by a temple, a Buddhist temple. So the long-term security.
So a leasehold property, essentially, where the owner of the land can at any time decide not to renew the lease, and then you'll have to remove yourselves, basically, right?
Right. Yeah. And they keep talking about tearing this house down, which would be a real shame because it's a Taisho house. So I'm a former contractor in California, and I have quite a bit of investment experience. I started very young buying property. My father was a contractor, carpenter, and the sort of what kicked off the whole real estate investment thing many, many years ago was a book by William Nickerson called How I Turned $1,000 into $3 million in my spare time, something like that. If you Google William Nickerson, and this was actually written right after the Great Depression, and he was the first person to actually publish a book about getting rich in real estate. And my father read that book and became really obsessed with it in the 1960s and started buying property shortly thereafter, rundown fixer-upper property. And he kind of got me started in it, taught me to be a carpenter. And then unfortunately, he died very young, at age 50. But he had a little property started, and I had been saving money, and I sort of jumped in and started doing the same thing. Right around that same time. And so I've fixed up and flipped, probably more than a dozen properties. And that may not sound like that much in houses, but some of them were big apartment buildings, multi, 10, 20 unit complexes and single family houses and all kinds of things like that. So that's my primary business, is real estate investing. And I still retain some apartment buildings in California, and I'm a partner in a 250 unit building on the East Coast. So real estate is my thing. And when I saw this place that Lieko has, I loved it. And so we did some remodeling on it. We Most Japanese houses don't have any insulation. So one of the first things I did was sort of figured out how to insulate in between the log rafters. A lot of the construction of the kominkas, of course, is not milled lumber, so you have to be pretty creative. And we came up with a way of doing two layers of 2-inch rigid foam between the log rafters. And then we did sheetrock, which is called Seiko Bordo in Japan. We did sheetrock over that. We ended up with about 4 inches of rigid foam, and then we did R 19 at least on the walls. We got more closer to R 30 on some of the walls, so we did some significant remodeling of her place there, even though we don't own it. But materials are cheap, and I was able to hire another carpenter to work with me. I mean, right now we're in October 2024 in this interview, and a carpenter here, a skilled carpenter, is about between $130 to $150 an hour. And we were able to hire a guy who was maybe not quite as knowledgeable as I am about sort of insulation and that stuff, but he was definitely faster than I was at straight carpentry. And we were able to get him for like $35 an hour. So that was absolutely wonderful. And then we added new what did we add? What did we add? Besides insulation, we did a new floor. We put a new floor in, and we also added a new air conditioning. Oh, and a dehumidifier, which is really important in Japan. So we kind of got the house really comfortable, but we don't own it. And Lieko's had it for about 12 years, but it just never felt that secure to me anyway. So I wanted to buy something there that we actually owned. I'm a bit older than Lieko. I'm about 18 years older than Lieko, and I would like her to have some extra security when I'm gone. And I'd like something to get passed on to her kids as well. So we did a lot of searching.
You look young enough, Michael. I don't see you going anywhere in the near future.
Well, I'm hoping I've got some years left, but anyway, so we did a lot of searching. We looked around Niigata.
Everywhere after
Yeah,
Aomori,
yeah, yeah. We looked.
Nagano.
Yeah, yeah. Nagano. We like Nagano a lot. That's a really beautiful area, and we spent some time there. And we went up to. We looked online in Akita and Aomori, but we actually drove all the way up to Yamagata looking at properties. And then we looked at a number of properties in Niigata. And I love Niigata. I had never been there before I met Lieko. I mostly did the Kyoto, Osaka, Tokyo, made it up to Hide Takayama, and I've done Kyushu and that whole thing. And I love Kyushu too. But Niigata is really it's really nice there. But in the long run, I guess my investor instinct kind of took over, and I thought, well, wait a minute, if we're going to buy something and really put a lot of effort into it, we want to have some sort of peripheral. I don't know if peripheral is the right word, but side potential for possible tourism, or maybe even Lieko's actually has worked with disabled children, and she's always been interested in she worked in the school system for many years with disabled kids as a teacher and trainer, helping kids sort of reassimilate. And so we thought, well, I mean, the house could even be like a daycare center, or what are the different possibilities? We wanted to find some place that had some land and enough space to maybe bring tourists in or do that kind of thing. So we sort of broadened our search, and we found this place down in Kyoto Prefecture that is 45 minutes to Amano-Hashidate, am I saying it right? I've been there, only been there a couple times, but Amano-Hashidate is really, really cool tourist attraction. And that is 45 minutes north. And then about an hour southeast is Tokyo, Kyoto City. And then an hour sort of slightly southwest is Himeji Castle. So the property is sort of geographically perfectly positioned, with some major tourist attractions there. We're sort of overlooking rice fields, and we've got mountains right behind us. We're sort of up on a hill. There's no neighbors in front of us. I mean, it really has a country feel. But you can get in the car, and we've timed it in 7 minutes. You can be in this Starbucks that's like 2,000 square feet. I mean, it's this massive Starbucks with couches all over. And I wish they had nice ones like that here. And then there's a bookstore attached to it that's like another 1,500 square feet of bookstore. And that's like 7 minutes away.
So
And
not a miserable little country town out in the sticks.
no, it's really. Can I mention the name of the town, or does
Yeah,
it?
of course.
Oh, okay. So Fukuchiyama, and we don't know the town that well, but the people, they recently, well, 1980s, I think they in the 1980s they raised millions of dollars and very carefully, accurately rebuilt their castle
Oh,
in
wow.
town. There's a little mountain right in the middle of the town. The whole town is around this little unusual mountain that pops up. And the castle was originally built by the guy that killed off Oda Nobunaga. What was his name again?
Mitsuhide.
Mitsuhide. And he actually is interesting because if you go sort of outside this area, Mitsuhide is sort of seen as a traitor because he killed Oda Nobunaga. But if you study Japanese history, which I have, I've been very interested in that whole period and Hideyoshi and Tokugawa and everything. Nobunaga was really bloodthirsty, and he was so they can in this area around Fukuchiyama, they consider him a hero
Oh, wow.
that
That's
he
really
killed
interesting, actually.
This shogun off. Yeah. So there's this very interesting, and to American tourists, this whole little history, I think, would be very interesting. So this castle was rebuilt in the 80s. The foundation was still there, but they managed to get photos. I guess during the Meiji Restoration, one of the decrees that was put out was that all of the feudal castles needed to be torn down. And some of them managed to avoid that. Like, fortunately, Himeji Castle and Osaka Castle. But unfortunately, Fukuchiyama's castle was dismantled on the order of Emperor Meiji. But they had really good photographs of it, so they rebuilt the whole thing. So that actually, to me, added a lot of value to our house because that's like 10 minutes from the house. And then there's also many, what are some of the departos there around our house?
Ion.
Aeon, there's an Aeon, which is a big nationwide department store. And then what was the other? There was electronic. Where would we buy the refrigerator?
Kids, no, George Yamada, kid, no,
Say less.
I don't remember.
Anyway, they're
A
big, big.
well-established commercial center. I get it.
So we took all of that sort of into consideration, and we drove around the town before we made an offer on this house. And I just looked for, major national chains. I looked for new construction. I'm not a big fan of modern Japanese houses, the newer Japanese architecture, but I looked for that. And if we saw new buildings going in, that was a really good sign. And I definitely felt like the economy was more vibrant here than some of the other areas I'd seen in smaller towns in Japan. I mean, Fukuchiyama is not a really big city. It's not a Osaka, obviously, or a Niigata City or something like that. But But we saw a lot of signs of economic development, and then we did a lot of homework too about just population decline. Fukuchiyama has actually been very stable. They've been tracking it since the late 60s, and it goes down 3 or 4%, and it goes back up 3 or 4%, and it's been pretty much stable population for the last 30, 40 years or so.
We interrupt this broadcast to tell you about Tokyo Family Stays. They're a short-term rentals company in Tokyo, and they offer a home away from home experience, which is just perfect for remote working, quarantining, if that's still a thing, or if you just need somewhere quiet to get away from the world. They offer a variety of options for families, corporate relocations, or even if you're simply transitioning between homes in Tokyo. The properties are super comfortable, tastefully furnished, fully equipped with all amenities, and they accommodate up to 10 people. So really the only thing you'll need to bring with you is your toothbrush and maybe a change of clothes. They come with fast, unlimited wireless internet, dedicated workspaces, and fully equipped kitchens. And they're just a delight to stay in, fantastic alternative to Japanese business hotels, which if you've ever stayed in one, you probably know they're tiny, they're noisy, fine for a night or two if you're on your own, but longer term or with a family, you'll probably feel you're in a jail cell very quickly in a Japanese business hotel. So if you want to give yourself a sense of space and freedom by renting a real home with comfortable Western beds, including all the necessities like baby bedding, children's toys, high chairs, etc., you definitely want to reach out to Tokyo Family Stays. They've been at it for over a decade. They're a fully licensed minpaku or short-term stay operator. And as a special bonus for our viewers and listeners, they're also throwing in a breakfast basket upon arrival for anyone who books and mentions the Japan Real Estate Podcast or NTI. And not only for guests, if you're a property owner, you've got an investment property that you want to tweak for higher profit, or a holiday home that you want to rent out when you're not using it via short-term stays, drop them a line today. See how they can help you maximize your property's income. And again, as a special bonus to our viewers and listeners, they're also offering a free audit of your existing short-term stay listings without any obligation whatsoever. So feel free to reach out to them at tokyofamilystays.com. Well worth a visit. And again, if you're in the market for a family home in or around the Tokyo metropolitan area, Emil's your man. Don't be shy to reach out to him as well at sales@realestate.jp. And now back to the podcast.
So we found a place that we both really liked, and it's about 4,000 square feet. It's quite large, and has two-car garages. With room for a workshop, and it had been significantly remodeled on the inside. It has a brand new Toto wet room, new bathroom, new laundry room, new daidokoro, new kitchen, and they had done quite a bit of work underneath the house to sort of re-supporting the construction's really interesting there. It's just most of it's post and beam, at least with the older properties. The newer places are using continuous foundations like we do in the Western world, but the older kominkas are primarily post and beam. And it was almost confusing for me at first because I saw all these rows of posts on blocks, and I didn't quite realize those weren't structural. Those are holding up the centers of the rooms, the tatami mats, which are essentially just sort of sitting on either 1x flat boards or plywood. But the house is actually standing on these, like what we would call 10x10 or 12x12 posts that come down and sit on a rock. A lot of resupporting had been done underneath the house, but nothing really earthquake structural. So that's one of the projects that I'm going to take on next time we're there. And I've actually been talking to some engineers, and it's not that difficult to earthquake retrofit these places with a little creativity. And a lot of the hold downs and earthquake straps and stuff that we have in the United States are also available in Japan. So that's going to be kind of a fun project. But most of the stuff you would see on the interior was in very good shape. They'd put a lot of new tatami mats in, and so it's very livable. It's basically move-in ready. I want to do earthquake retrofitting, and I want to do the installation that I talked about that we did up in Niigata. I want to also do that.
So it ticked all of your boxes. And how long were you looking before you landed on that one?
How long does we
Couple of trips, didn't we?
find April, I think, find this house.
Yeah.
April, and that time we couldn't go there.
Oh, that's
Yeah.
right. Yeah. So we were there in April of last year, and we had looked at a lot of places, and we found this place like the day before we were leaving. And we tried to change our flight, and our travel agent just really flaked out on us. We had booked through a travel agent, and apparently when a travel agent books your flights, you can't change them. Only the travel agent can change them.
I didn't know that. Okay.
And I didn't know that either, but we were flying JAL, and we had, I think, economy plus seats, and they wouldn't let us. We had to start all over again and buy like $10,000. There are four of us. We have two kids. We would have had to spend $10,000 on a whole new batch of tickets, and who knows whether we would have gotten refunded anything. So we ended up just flying home and kind of frustrated because we wanted to, we were on our way to Tokyo, and we wanted to divert down to Kyoto Prefecture. But and then when did we went back in August?
No, June, last of June,
Oh, June. Oh, that's
June.
right. That's right. Okay, I'm terrible with months of timing. I hardly remember yesterday. So I just have so much stuff going on too with my business. I rely on her to remind me. But then we went back, and the place was had been in contract actually with a Canadian, and that person had backed out, possibly maybe because of some of the foundation stuff. People look underneath there and aren't sure what they're looking at, and I felt
You were, just to clarify for me, you are comfortable with your own experience and professionalism that you didn't feel you need an official structural inspection, right?
no, I didn't. We did hire a couple of carpenters through the realtor that I wanted to just actually get their take on the place, but I also wanted an estimate, like what they would, just a ballpark to see what a local contractor company would charge to do some of the earthquake retrofitting. And they actually came up from Kyoto. And I think as a result of that, they were very expensive. I mean, the inspection wasn't that much. It was like $400 to have them come up from Kyoto. But then when they submitted the bid a few weeks later, it was like more than we paid for the house.
Right. How
And
much was the house, if it's okay to share?
we paid the house was they were asking, well, in US dollars they were asking 165, and
Oh, and retrofitting it would have cost more than that. Wow.
cost more than that. And I can retrofit this thing for I can hire another carpenter and retrofit this place myself, probably for about $15,000,
Right.
maybe about 15,000, I think maybe $20,000 at the most. I can completely earthquake retrofit it. So their price was just sort of astronomical. Well, they did include insulation and some other things too, but still, it was kind of ridiculous. And the economy in these smaller towns is much more reasonable than, I mean, you don't want to hire, if you're in a small town, try to hire from around the small town. You don't want to go to a bigger
100%.
city.
Totally
You
agree
don't
with
want to go
that.
to a bigger city to
Yeah.
hire people that are already busy and have plenty of work, and pay them to travel and all that kind of stuff.
So you had a good idea of how much it would cost you, but whatever work needs to be done on the property, it wasn't an unknown and it wasn't anything scary for you.
Yeah, well, just my own experience working on a kominka up in Niigata and everything. So I felt pretty comfortable with it. So we really like the place. It's really an amazing house. It's got three toilet rooms, which, very few houses in Japan
Very
have
few, yeah.
three toilets, a really nice big todo wet room, like I said, big ki open kitchen, open ceiling. The ceilings are about 24 feet high with big log beams like this visible. And I mean, it's a real Taisho era, almost looks like Meiji, kind of Meiji era. Komeika, which I like. I mean, there's several different architectures I really like on these earlier houses. Tile roof and the whole deal. But where we actually really got into trouble, where I didn't think we were going to have any trouble, because I've bought and sold a number of properties in California. I'm a good negotiator. I'm good at finding property and negotiating the close. I was completely out of my element, and that's when I contacted you. And I want to say right here on the recording here that you really bailed us out here, because I was offending the seller, and I was, I mean, I was doing American style, California style negotiating, where it's like the flea market, right? They want $20, and you offer 10, and you hope he's going to come back at 15. But when he wants 20 and you offer 10, he's insulted and deal's over, and it's just a whole different, it's a completely different world.
And
And then,
to clarify for people listening, we were not involved at all at that point, right? We just spoke a few times on some basic market stuff.
right. But you did give me some advice. Early on, you cautioned me about some of the very real basics in terms of mistakes. And then later we hired you, and you helped us in the actual closing of the deal, which was also really complicated. From my perspective, I guess, you've done 1,000 of them, but we had
Not
issues.
quite, but maybe half that, yeah.
Yeah, well, we had issues with the Scrivener. The Scrivener was like, had this ego, and insisted that we had to get this notary thing at the U.S. consulate. Which is, I mean, if you ever try to get hold of the U.S. consulate in Tokyo or Osaka, we were doing Osaka, which is easier than Tokyo. I mean, it takes weeks and weeks and weeks to get an appointment, and you can do an emergency appointment, but just getting the email to go through is, I mean, took me like 4 days of repeatedly trying to get my email through, and it was a nightmare. And this Scrivener was just really gummed up the works for us. And then you informed us that we could just go to any Japanese notary, and in fact, that was the document that we used to close the deal, was just a regular notary
But
from
we
Japan.
did have to involve another scrivener, right? Because that was the one appointed by the seller or by the seller's agent, I'm assuming.
That was one appointed by the seller,
Who
and
probably has never worked with a non-resident foreigner, so was just looking up on the internet how to do it and saw embassy somewhere.
And that Scrivener was, we were really happy to see him go. He had a big ego, and he really didn't know what he was doing. And you hooked us up with people that could communicate in English and Japanese and knew exactly how to do this. And I mean, that really helped save the deal. And of course, the realtor we were dealing with, I mean, that's another difference in Japan. In California and all of America, as far as US, as far as I know, there's a very strict sort of ethical system where the buyer has an agent and the seller has an agent, and they each represent you. It's just like having two lawyers and you're negotiating, your lawyers are negotiating. If you have one lawyer, it's a little hard to, and you have two sort of opposing parties, it doesn't really work. In Japan, there's very often one realtor. And it's tough because whose allegiance is that realtor with? So what I decided, and you had advised me as well, that I just really needed to do a lot of my own homework. And Lieko, my wife, really helped. We went to City Hall. We met with, we went to a number of different offices. Mm-hmm. We went to a number of different City Hall offices and researched the property, looked it up on maps with people from City Hall, and did a lot of our own research, which was really important. But you can hire your own realtor in Japan, but it becomes more expensive also, because they need to get their piece of the pie, and they don't. Well, just...
Not if the seller's agent is agreeing to share, to let them represent the buyer. But if the seller's agent is greedy and want to charge both sides, then yes, you do need to pay them separately.
Yeah, well, you could speak on that more than I could. But if you have a listing and the realtor already has that listing, I would think he or she would be reluctant to say, sure, come on in and split my commission with me.
Unless they can't find a buyer by themselves. But the problem starts when they don't really, they're officially the seller's agent, but it's not like they really have the seller's interest in mind. They're just there to facilitate the purchase. So rather than get the quickest and best sale price for the seller, they would rather hold out and wait an extra few months, because maybe some potential buyer will find them on their own. They won't have to share. So they're just acting in their self-interest, not really on anyone's side.
Yeah. Well, then the other factor that you have to layer into this is, if you find a place that's amazing, it's not going to stay on the market forever. You know, there's other people there looking. So,
correct.
So you have to make a decision. You know, if the realtor doesn't want to split the commission, you have to make the decision: is this place amazing enough that I'm either going to do all my own research and make sure I'm covering my own, you know, my own interests, and just go with this one realtor, or am I willing to pay the extra money and pay for my own realtor, and also, you know, make sure this realtor gets their money? So
have to make sure that the realtor is asking the right questions. I mean, the fact that they're appointed by you doesn't necessarily mean they're going to proactively act on your behalf without being told what to look for, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. So
now here's some big news for anyone interested in Akiya, the abandoned vacant homes that are abundant all around Japan for very attractive purchase prices. Akiya Mart, our latest sponsor, is a recently founded online search and discovery tool for Japanese real estate. Its user interface will be very familiar to users of Zillow or Redfin. The platform essentially scouts the internet for property listings, translates them into English, and displays prices in US dollars, all in one place, and with a dynamic map interface that makes browsing, finding, and shortlisting your favorite properties a piece of cake. Which any of you have been struggling with the dozens, if not hundreds, of Japanese property websites that are available online and their very clunky interface will probably find a real blessing. They've got already over 500,000 listings on the platform, and the database is expanding daily. Ranging from abandoned rural homes to luxury urban properties, Akiya Mart makes it easy to find your dream home in Japan, regardless of your budget. Now, while the platform is essentially free for use, here's an exclusive offer for listeners of the podcast. You can use the promo code NTI to receive $5 off Akiya Mart Pro. The subscription will unlock a bunch of very attractive features for you, including unrestricted access to the entire nationwide property database and a whole range of filters, which will help power charge your search for that elusive perfect home and make it even easier. So hop over to akiya-mart.com. That's AKIYA-MART, akiya-mart.com, and kick off your search today.
So we ended up just working with this guy, this one realtor, and we, at first, you know, I didn't trust him. His office was very small in Osaka. I mean, it was a hole in the wall with no sign, like went in through the back door, and it was a condo unit.
Yeah.
It was a condo basically that had been turned into an office. And I was just like, really nervous. In fact, I even turned my phone video on and put it down just so we could record audio of what people were saying, because I thought, you know, what am I got some Yakuza operation or something here. But he turned out to be really great, and he actually was really happy when you replaced the Scrivener with your Scrivener. He really liked working with the new Scrivener, and since then he's just been wonderful. He's helped us. He's hooked us up with some service people installing air conditioners and dehumidifiers, and they've gotten us better prices than we could. We checked around, and they're super competitive prices. And we even stopped in there to see the work they were doing. And so the realtor's actually taken an interest in us and in the property. And he's been really great. But back to the deal itself, there were multiple things that were just completely different than purchasing property in the West. So if we purchased anything again in Japan, we would probably call you before we even started looking. And
What were some of those things from memory? What were some of those things that kind of took you by surprise?
well, I mean, part of it, of course, was as I said, was the conflict of interest where a realtor, you don't have two realtors. There is that does happen in the United States sometimes, but it's called double ending a deal. And if the buyer and the seller, are okay with it, they can both sign a legal document and have one realtor represent them. But both parties have to be really confident about what's happening. And usually the realtor will discount their percentage a little bit. It's 6% normally, and they'll knock it down. If they have to split it, it's 3% to each realtor. If they double end it, potentially they could ask for 6%, but they'll usually take 4.5 or something like that, or at least 5 to do it. But it's not that common in the US, but it's sort of the standard thing in Japan. So that was the first thing I had to sort of get over. Was getting used to that idea. The other big thing was this law that was passed a few years ago, limiting Airbnb to 6 months, called the Minpaku law. And that, I don't want to get into a political thing here on your podcast, but I think, back in 2015 or so, I was going to Japan, and a lot of the Airbnb condos and stuff were owned by foreigners, primarily like Chinese investors and things like that. And I think this a lot of foreign, not just Chinese, obviously, but other foreigners were purchasing property. And I think the Minpaku law kind of came in to try to slow down foreign investment in the country. That's sort of what it appears to be from me. And I have mixed feelings about it. I can see why Japanese people have a concern about lots of foreigners buying lots of property. But on the other
It's
hand,
interesting that you think that. I always thought that it was a case of them not honestly not wanting to see foreigners walking up and down the street and up and down the building elevator and then complaining to local municipalities about it. Plus a lot of pressure from the hotel lobby who didn't really want Airbnb to be that popular here. But that's an angle I didn't even think about.
yeah, well, that's true too. There's definitely the big hotel chains, I think, definitely put pressure on the government to do the Minpaku law. There's no doubt about that. But regardless, that was something that kind of threw us off, and that was one of the things we spent several days researching in at City Hall, trying to get our own information. And then you hooked us up with yet another professional. And I can't remember, his name was Shun or
Shun, Matsuki Shun-san from Smart Inn. They're the best resource I know for short-term stay research.
I mean, that was once again, that was a benefit of hiring you to consult for us and help us. And that was wonderful because he, I mean, in a matter of like 24 hours, he basically presented us everything that we had also found out that took us about a week. Took us about a week to get the information that he got for us in about 24 hours. But it was reassuring that we did it ourselves, and we talked to people at City Hall, and we kind of got names and business cards, and we made connections. And then we got this reassurance from your connection that sort of, you know, because in Japan, a lot of stuff is a little vague. Well, in the United States, stuff's much more cut and dried. You know, it's just like, yes or no. You know, this is the rule, and yes, you can do Airbnb here, or no, you can't do this. And in Japan, it's just kind of like nobody wants to commit, you know? So we got the closest thing we could get to 100% confirmation that we could do Airbnb, which was great. So so we're happy now about the place. We just are trying to figure out how to get back. We have a kid in high school here that's got another year and a half or so. So we're kind of stuck here, and we can run back in the summers and do work. But now it's just a matter of trying to get back to the house and work on it and start kind of going back and forth a bit.
Well, from your experience, this being your first purchase, and yourself with Rieko there as your Japanese spouse, so taking all of the context of your particular experience as a builder, as a person married to a Japanese spouse, and as a person who's never purchased a property in Japan before, what sort of tips would you give to anyone approaching this for the first time? Like, what would you advise them to think about, consider, do ahead of time, during the process, after the purchase?
Yeah, well, that's interesting. Well, I think it depends a lot on the person's individual circumstances. I mean, if they're already living in Japan, or whether they're in Europe or the US or something, and they're looking for a second home to live part-time. You know, I have to say, I mean, my Nihongo is pretty limited. I've got a few dozen words, and that's about it. So to me, you either have to be fairly proficient at Japanese, or you have to have a Japanese spouse. That's the first... That's the first order of business.
Or a Japanese representative who can also speak to you in English, right? Whether it's a buyer side agent or someone like us or somebody you hire for that purpose, but somebody with a Japanese language abilities and a Japanese face, right?
Well, yeah, that goes back to the purpose. Like, if it's an investor, you don't need to speak Japanese, and you don't need a Japanese wife or husband. I mean, if you're an investor, and there's some great investment opportunities, obviously, in Japan. So yeah, so I stand corrected. I mean, if you're looking for a place to live part-time, and this is going to be your either vacation home, or I was sort of speaking from that side, it's really helpful to have a partner who can speak, or you speak yourself. But if you're an investor looking to diversify or invest in Japan, all you need is somebody like yourself to help put a deal together. Absolutely. But my feeling, you know, I'm sort of a hands-on kind of guy. I guess it's possible to purchase. I hear about people purchasing property sight unseen. But for us, we were looking for a place we wanted to live, and maybe live half the year or even more. So we wanted to really look at properties and check out communities. And, you know, Japan is absolutely wonderful. I mean, it's, you can leave your purse or your wallet on the train and you know, get off at the stop and then realize your purse or wallet just took off on the train, and you're going to get it back. You know, you just make the phone call and it's waiting for you at the next stop. And, you know, people find it, and they don't dare open it. And It's a completely different world. I mean, I remember the first time I went to Japan, I got on the subway, and I remember this distinctly because I was restoring a 1890s historic landmark, Victorian at the time, and we had a bunch of furniture that we had picked out to stage it with that was mohair. This beautiful 100% wool mohair, which is very expensive upholstery fabric and can be a little delicate. And this subway train was upholstered in mohair. And and I couldn't believe it because people in America put their cigarettes out. It says no smoking right above their head, and they put their cigarettes out on the chair, on the seats of the train or the subway. So Japan is just a wonderful, clean, safe country with very friendly people, and it's just a wonderful place. So I think it's a great place to invest if you want to own apartment buildings or rentals and have tenants that are just
Hassle
easy to deal
free,
with.
right?
Yeah, hassle. Well, compared to the West, yeah, I mean, yeah, very. Or if you want a second home or you want to retire there. I mean, we've been finding, we go out to dinner a lot. I like to go out to dinner, and we've got two kids, and we often bring Lieko's father with us. So there's five of us, and we go out for really nice dinners in Japan, and it's like $40, $45 US. And we completely pig out on the best sushi and all this stuff. And in the US, that's $200, easily $200 for five people to have dinner. It's ridiculously expensive. So Japan's also an amazing place to retire. I mean, it's half price at least, sometimes 25% of what you have to pay in the US for.
Now, if you've attended any of our recent JREP Summit events in Tokyo or online, you've probably heard our sponsor, Robert Miller from Innovatius.com. He's been in web solutions here in Japan for the past 25 years, and he's also an active investor in Japanese real estate property, as well as global online property, which is his specialty and what his company, Innovatius, is all about. They offer a full suite of website services for entrepreneurs and small business owners, including all aspects of web design and management, backup and updates, content formatting and editing, proactive maintenance and error fixing, you name it, with a strong focus on SEO excellence, which is what gets you those hardcore top-of-the-list search engine rankings. But there is a difference. Innovatius works off a simple, all-inclusive monthly subscription model, as opposed to the typical outdated and confusing project model. So you never have to wonder how much any request for any work to be done on your website might cost. It's always $497 per month. And if that's not enough, if you've mentioned you've heard of their services on the Japan Real Estate Podcast, you'll also get 10% off this monthly price for life. Also, and equally important, if not more, you can try out Innovatius for just 1 month, then switch them off. On again later if you want, and so forth. There are no minimum subscription terms. Now, if you're a small business owner, managing and growing a website is super distracting and time-consuming, right? That's exactly where Innovatius comes in. Robert's team takes care of all of that for you so that you can focus on what you do best. So feel free to email Rob on robert@innovatius.com. And his team will conduct a full SEO and website audit on your site, reveal anything that you should address to increase your website's appeal, and provide you with an easy-to-read, detailed report with your own branding so that you can make some informed decisions on your online strategy and watch your business grow as you implement it. So once more, robert@innovatius.com. Drop him a line and get your website reviewed today.
Ask for
But
things.
the bad, not the bad stuff, but stuff that you really need to watch out for, I guess, for people to be aware. I mean, this is Japan Real Estate Podcast. We can sing the praises of Japan's real estate market for days. But I think what I want people to understand is the differences, what they should and shouldn't expect. Like you've mentioned the negotiation, you've mentioned the agent situation, stuff like that that people should be aware of before they get into these adventures.
Well, I mean, disclosure laws in the United States are very strict. And if you don't disclose something, you can get in really big trouble. And a buyer can come back retroactively if something wasn't disclosed and they don't discover it for 6 months or a year that some sewer line was broken or something that the seller knew about, the seller is responsible. And there's nothing like that really, as far as I know, in Japan. So you really, it would be, if you're not a contractor or somebody with a lot of house experience, house restoration experience, it would be a very good idea to hire one of the inspection services that you had mentioned. I guess that those are engineers, or you said a full engineer,
Architectural engineers, yes, correct.
architectural engineer. Yeah, I would. If I, if I was an accountant or something like that, and I was buying in Japan, I would definitely hire some, professional inspections and stuff. I mean, I crawled under the house myself. I put a white coveralls on, and I went under the entire house with flashlight and took many photographs of the structure underneath. And
But you know what you're doing.
yeah, well, I was trying to figure out how I'm going to design an earthquake retrofit. But yeah, but I would definitely hire. So that's the first thing, because disclosure laws are very different there. So, but that's, we're talking a few hundred bucks, right, to hire that kind of an inspection. What is architectural engineer cost to do a
Depending on the size of the house, but somewhere between 800 to I'd say 1500. Yeah.
1500 yen?
No, between 800 to $1500. Yeah.
Oh yeah, okay, I thought you said. Yeah, well, still, that's, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, that's very reasonable to have a real airtight inspection. So, I don't know. I assume that would include a roof inspection, because one of the things I learned is that these tile, I don't know much about tile as a builder. I never really
That's
worked.
separate. That's usually an extra $500, $600. These days they do it with drones, so it's not as expensive as it used to be with all the scaffolding required, but that's probably on top of that. Yeah.
So one of the things I learned looking at Kominka is, if you're looking at a really old Kominka, apparently these tiles actually do have a life expectancy.
Yep.
And some of the tiles are there, some of those brown ones we saw, and
Yeah, some little different color there.
some of the I mean the some of the older tiles do need to be replaced, and they're heavier than the newer tiles too. So that can make, that can be an issue for earthquake considerations and stuff like that. So if you're looking at a really old Kominka, new tile might be one of the things that you sort of assume. Oh, it's got tile, so it's fine. It's going to last forever, but that's not necessarily the case. So that was one of the things I learned. I'm trying to think of what else to be cautious about. I would just say, hire inspect.
Aware of, not necessarily cautious, just assumptions that people might make that might not necessarily be correct here.
Well, I would say the disclosure laws are different, so you just want to do your lots of research, or hire your people, which were very helpful, especially for the Minpaku issue. And then hire hire this home inspection. We have those here also, run about the same price. They're about seven, eight
Don't
hundred.
try to lowball too much for fear of offending the seller. We've mentioned that.
You want to be careful about that. Although, I did offer 150. There were He was asking 165. And I mean, quite frankly, for 4,000 square feet with two-car garages and a bunch of remodel that had been done to this place, and it's on a half an acre, I mean, in California, that's not even anywhere close to a down payment, what we paid for this place.
Yep.
So, I mean, the value, and then we also caught it, if you recall, we exchanged most of the money right around 160, between 150 and 160 yen.
Yep.
I think I did one of the exchange. I think I exchanged 50 $50,000 right when it hit 160, which was fantastic. And it's still quite low. I mean, compared to, I mean, because it's been 1 to 1 in the past. So I think we're hovering around 145 or something right now, which is
Still great, yeah,
yeah,
for
still
buyers, yeah.
pretty great for the buyer. Yeah. So yeah, that's, I would just say do your homework. It really depends on what you're looking for too. Like I said, I'm more of a fan of the older homes. I think they can be worked with, and there's this whole thing going on with Japan right now. There's a lot of talk. I've read some articles about sort of changing construction a bit, because sort of traditional, well, not, I don't know whether I want to say traditionally, because traditionally, if you go back to Taisho or even early Showa, and the Meiji era houses, they were really built to last. They were built with big beams, and they were really built to last. And then something happened around mid Showa. I think it was the 40s or something, or 50s.
Probably World War I was the start of that, and then World War II definitely didn't help.
Yeah, well, something changed in which houses were built to only last like for one family, one generation, basically.
Correct.
And then you come in and you tear the house down, and then you build a new house. But the Japanese government is starting to realize that that does not build intergenerational wealth, right? And you really want houses that are built to last longer, that can be passed on and can grow the net worth of a family. So I'm personally fond in terms of homes. I mean, apartment buildings are a whole different thing, and they're built to a different standard. If you're an investor looking for, residential income property, it's a different thing. But in terms of homes, I really am a fan of the older homes, and they do need some work. You've got to be careful. You've got to get your estimates and stuff. But those homes were built really solid, and big beams, and
I agree. We tell most of our customers either buy something that's hopefully 20 years or at least 30 years and younger if you're buying something modern. Otherwise, if you're going older and traditional, go all the way back to when they were actually built properly.
exactly. Yeah,
And
and
they do cost more to maintain and repair when something does need to be done, but they'll be there for decades.
well, and cost more. When you say cost more, it's kind of relative too, because you're talking everything is so much cheaper that if you do need to do some work to the house.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we're having, how many air conditioners are we adding?
Six.
This house had, I guess, older air conditioners and things that all got pulled out. So when we bought the house, it had been remodeled, many new tatami mats, the new kitchen, bathroom, all that stuff, but it didn't have any air conditioners or heaters or anything. Everything had been taken out, and we're putting sort of top of the line. We're fond of Daikin ourselves. Daikin and Mitsubishi are the only two air conditioner companies that are still made in Japan, by the way.
I didn't know
Everything,
that. Okay.
yeah, everything else is made overseas, mostly in China. So Mitsubishi or Daikin, and Daikin only makes air conditioners. That's all they do, is air conditioners and dehumidifiers. So, and they have a little better record in terms of longevity and that sort of stuff. So we're doing
That's a
top of
very
the
good
line.
tip, actually. Thank you.
Yeah, well, we're doing all Daikin. We put in, how many dehumidifiers do we put in?
Two, three,
And we put in one,
one, two. Now
three,
we
four.
have three,
We
and
had
we
four.
are the
So we're
first.
doing four. We have four dehumidifiers in them, and each one can do, a pretty big area. And it's a big house, 4,000 square feet, two stories. And then
Six air
we're
conditioners.
adding six big air conditioners. And I mean, the whole thing is like $13,000. So I mean, you couldn't even you couldn't even get two of those installed here in the US for
You're
that
right. I
much.
should have put a caveat on that when I said more expensive. I was speaking to our listeners who have this assumption in mind, and that's probably something you can speak to as well, is that I'll get out there, I'll buy something really, really cheap for 20, 30, $40,000, whatever those IKEAs cost, and then I won't have to pour that much money into it. It's good to go. So that's not the case.
Well, it just depends on how far you want to take it. I mean, if you're going to buy, most of the IKEAs are pretty run down. The tatami mats are old, and we looked at a bunch of places that were, pretty sad. I mean, pots and pans still on the stove, and like grandma got hauled out and sent to a rest home or something, and the house is just sort of frozen in time. And we looked at quite a few of those places, and some of them are beautiful, beautiful old places with amazing woodwork and just beautiful built-ins, and I mean there's some amazing stuff, but you should save some budget for upgrades for sure. One of the things we saw probably the most is a Daidokoro and Otera, right? So mostly bathrooms. Pretty much plan on remodeling a bathroom and remodeling the kitchen. Most of the older abandoned homes have bathrooms from the 50s, 50s or 60s or something, and definitely need some remodeling. But still, when you compare real estate in other first world countries, I mean, there's just no comparison. I mean, Japan is truly a first world country with first world, medical, first world transportation, communications. I mean, it's a first world country, and you're getting, you're buying real estate at sort of 1970s prices compared to, at least compared to the US. So it's a pretty amazing frontier for a real estate investor, I think.
That
So
that's a very good tip as well.
anyway, but well, we both want to say again how much we appreciate you were always available. We messaged you a lot. We messaged you on Saturdays, on Sundays, and you
Don't
always
let
respond.
people get used to it. I don't usually answer on Saturdays and Sundays.
But you did for us because we were right in the middle of a tough negotiation and things. Our deal almost fell apart too at one point. I think I tried to get that. What did I do? I did my typical California negotiating, and I tried to get the buyer to split some cost with me. What was that? Oh, the Scrivener. I think I tried to get him with the Scrivener with me, of course he almost walked away from the deal on that. He got so offended, but we got it smoothed over, and we ended up meeting him, and we got him paid, but I would not try to purchase in Japan with just a realtor. I would definitely use your services, because you is there's a lot more involved than just the just signing papers.
I appreciate that, and it's not the purpose of the call, but thank you for saying that. That's very kind of you.
Well, I mean, I've done a lot of real estate deals, and I was like a deer in the headlights. And I didn't think I was going to be. I thought, oh, I've got this, this is going to be easy. But anyway, we're really excited to have the place. It's a very cool looking property, and it's got view. It's got these amazing views out over. I mean, there's about 2,000 acres of rice fields, like right in front of the
Oh,
house,
wow.
and the neighbors are a half a mile away over on the other side of the rice field. So we have one farmer neighbor near us on one side, but otherwise we're up against, I don't know if that's national park or something, but there's a Kofun, Kofun,
Kofun.
Kofun, Kofun, a tomb, an ancient tomb like right behind us in wild land. So we don't have neighbors sandwiched around us. We're really, we're really out in the countryside, and we don't have any neighbors breathing down our neck or anything. It's just a very cool property. So we're
You're
excited.
happy with the purchase. We'll need to get some photos and videos from you once you get back there.
Well, I'll send you some. I have really great photos of it. I'll send some photos to you online here. So
That'd be great. I'll add them to the video. Well, thank you. Thank you very much for your time. And thank you for, again, allowing us to record. I think that'll be beneficial and valuable for a lot of people listening who are maybe just approaching this purchase for the first time and wondering how things can go. So nothing really went wrong, but there are things to be aware of that people should know before getting into it. And I think you've outlined a lot of these. So thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, we really appreciate it. We appreciate your help, and if we purchase something else, and I may look at buying some units or something there. We'd call you first.
That would be our pleasure as always.
Okay. All
Thank you
right.
very much. Talk to you soon.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So there you have it. The do's, don'ts, and watch outs of the Japanese property purchase process. Yes, it's very similar logistically to what you may think that you know if you've done this before anywhere else in the world. But those tiny and not so tiny differences, which definitely do exist, can really cause some serious frustrations if you're not familiar with them in advance, or at least have somebody on your side who is. So I hope you found some value in this one. Now, before we go, we're also, as always, going to tell you and also link to our other sponsor's website. That's Hiroshi Shimizu, immigration lawyer and administrative scrivener. If you're thinking about moving here on a more permanent basis, or you're already in Japan on some sort of a temporary visa and you want to switch to a longer term or permanent one, or if you're considering setting up a local company or a branch office of a foreign company and you've got any sort of business or visa-related inquiries, or even if you just want to find out what your options are on any of these topics, feel free to contact Hiroshi Shimizu. You can find him at japanimmigrationexperts.com, and he can help you set up a company, apply for any kind of visa, or just provide you with the best advice and extremely affordable consultation related to these topics. And he's already done that for many of our listeners. So feel free to reach out to him. Again, that's japanimmigrationexperts.com, and you'll be well on your way. And that's it from us for today, folks. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Japan Real Estate Podcast. Do share it with your networks and please let us know what you think. So leave us a short rating or review on the iTunes Store, on Spotify, or just drop us a line in the comment section of wherever you might have found this episode. We love hearing from you. Hope to have you with us again next time. And until then, have a great day or night ahead. Yoroshiku.